So today, I will be taking you on a journey of exploration of the Antarctic continent. And for those of you who don't know, the Antarctic continent is at the South Pole, and it's really one of the major unknowns of our planet. It's the last frontier on Earth. What do we actually do with airborne geophysics? Well, something quite simple, really. What I'm just about going to do with the mouse, which is basically reveal what lies beneath the Antarctic ice sheets. And so this is really quite a prime tool to go and explore this continent in a rather cost-effective way, and really a way to discover and unravel the secrets that are locked beneath the ice. So as I was saying before, Antarctica is really a huge continent. This gives you an idea of the extent, 4,000 kilometers across in the two directions. And the continent is basically entirely buried by these ice sheets. There's a very large ice sheet called the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, and a smaller ice sheet called the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, and a separate, smaller ice sheet there, which is called the Antarctic Peninsula Ice Sheet. So what lies beneath the Antarctic ice sheets? Well, it's a continent with very different characteristics. We have one part, what lies under the East Antarctic ice sheet, which is, generally speaking, at high elevations. And then we have another part of the continent, what lies under the West Antarctic ice sheet, that is at low elevations. It's generally below sea level. And this first fundamental difference is quite important as a boundary condition for the ice sheets themselves. So the Antarctic continent itself extends for about 12 million square kilometers. East Antarctica on its own is the size of the contiguous United States of America, to give you an idea. But the ice-free area is only about 45,000 square kilometers. So less than 1% basically has rock outcrop. So it's obvious that to understand the processes that formed and continue to form the Antarctic continent, and to understand the ice sheet processes themselves, we must explore under the ice sheet. So the Antarctic continent, as can be seen schematically here, it's really a keystone in the supercontinental puzzle. Antarctica used to be at the center of a supercontinent called Gondwana, and it's this breakup of the supercontinent that eventually isolated Antarctica and enabled the growth of ice sheets over the continent. So Antarctic geology is really an essential component to understand the Earth system as a whole. Another thing that really attracts attention in Antarctica is the fact that the ice sheets themselves are very sensitive to climate change. And this is particularly the case for the West Antarctic ice sheet that appears to be very sensitive to rapid climate change, with a great potential for accelerated sea level rise from melting and collapse of the ice sheet. But there's also mounting evidence that the East Antarctic ice sheet itself may not be as stable as commonly assumed. So with airborne geophysics, we actually investigate the ice sheets themselves, the structures that lie in the ice, and explore under the ice to try and unravel subglacial landforms, geology, and deeper crustal structure. This gives you an idea of the coverage of the Antarctic continent from previous surveys that were collected over 50 years since the International Geophysical Year. And from this type of data, you get what you can see on the right-hand side, a picture of the subglacial topography that lies beneath the ice sheets. I shall be showing you some new insights into different parts of the Antarctic continent that we have explored, in particular some areas in Dronning Moorland here in this part of Antarctica, this part here, the Amundsen Sea embayment region of Antarctica, and also the enigmatic Gambergs of subglacial mountains in the interior of East Antarctica. So how do we do airborne geophysics? Well, first of all, we need a plane, of course. And in fact, we've got two different planes. We've got a Twin Otter, which is equipped with airborne radar, aeromagnetics, and airborne gravity. And this aircraft is ski-equipped, so it allows us to operate also from deep field camps, quite far away from the main bases in the Antarctic continent. And we've used this platform quite extensively. As you can see there, field seasons in 2001, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and most recently 10, 11. So basically every 2 years or so, so far we've managed to get to the Antarctic continent and use this aircraft. Typically, during a flight to explore the continent, we do about 1,000 kilometers, and the amount of line kilometers that we can actually fly during an entire field season is strongly a function of how much fuel we have and how much logistics we have in deep field. So this is highly variable, really. So in the survey, we might do something between 5 and 10,000 line kilometers, up to even 60,000 line kilometers. So over the distance of going right around the Earth. So it's quite a large amount of flying that we can do. And the survey durations are, again, highly variable, between 25 and 270 hours. We also have a different aircraft, which is not ski-equipped, but it's a much larger aircraft. It's a Dash 7. And this aircraft, unfortunately, we cannot perform radar on, but we can fly aeromagnetics and airborne gravity at the moment. And this needs a landing strip, and so we've used it primarily from our base in the Antarctic Peninsula at Rotherham. This is a really unique platform that can fly very large distances, so in a flight we can achieve as much as 2,200 kilometers, so over double what we can get with a Twin Otter. So there are three key techniques that we can use to explore these ice-covered areas with airborne geophysics. Airborne radar, and this gives us indications on the ice thickness in glacial structures, so layers in the ice, bedrock topography and geomorphology, and also the water that lies beneath the ice, sub-ice hydrology. We use airborne magnetics. This gives us indications on the basement geology, its architecture, including subglacial faults. It gives us a proxy of what we call depth to magnetic basement, which gives us an indication of how thick sediments may be under the ice. And also, although this is more of a challenge, it can give us indications of depth to Courier isotherm, which is basically the depth at which the rocks lose their magnetic properties. And this can be used potentially as a proxy to estimate geothermal deep flux. We also use airborne gravity. This is a relatively more recent technique compared to radar and magnetics. And with increasing precision in GPS techniques, it has allowed us really to glean new insights into, for example, crustal thickness, sedimentary basin thickness, and elastic properties of the lithosphere. So you can see that basically the combination of these methods allows us to look from the surface right down to crustal depths. So we use different equipment. We use cesium magnetometers that are very precise magnetometers that allow us to really measure very accurately changes in the magnetic field. We have airborne an LNR gravimeter modified by ZLS. This is in essence a marine gravimeter that's modified for airborne operations. And then we have an airborne radar system which is built in-house to get basically both bedrock topography and layers within the ice. And of course, critically, we have an airborne survey navigation system composed primarily of GPS. So this is a picture of the Twin Otter in deep field. The radar that we use has a center frequency of 150 megahertz. We have two magnetometers in wingtip configuration. And we need also a magnetometer to compensate for the magnetic effects of the aircraft. And this is a flux gauge magnetometer. And as I previously said, we have GPS units for the navigation. also quite important, as the aircraft moves away from bases, we also need to monitor how the magnetic field varies. And so we have what we call base stations, a magnetometer which is on the ground and measures how the external magnetic field is varying, because we are interested in how the field varies in space. So we've got to take out the effects of the external variations of the magnetic field. Also, to get very accurate measurements of positioning, we need to have a GPS also on the ground, which allows us to correct the positional data of the aircraft. So welcome aboard our BAS Airborne Geophysical Airlines aircraft. And here you can see we've got quite a lot of equipment inside the aircraft. And the fundamental thing for the operator to remember, of course, is to switch actual equipment on, which can sometimes be quite tricky. There's quite a lot of stuff here. And you can see there are different racks. And the operator, in essence, gets to see what you see there, the display rack, where he can monitor the radar, the magnetics, and the gravity simultaneously. So we operate in quite light mode with just one operator that has to basically do all of this different work. So I was telling you that Antarctica is a centerpiece within the Gondwana supercontinent. And this is a rather nice animation that shows you how indeed Antarctica became separated from the other continents that lie around. The colors that you see there are colors actually of satellite gravity anomalies that provide us with some sort of proxy to what the topography might look like under the ice. And so it already gives you some sort of picture of Antarctica and the surrounding continents. So here you can see at about 120 million years, India rifts off from East Antarctica. At 80 million years, we now have a big Indian Ocean. At about 60 million years, we get Australia drifting off from East Antarctica. And by about 20 million years, Antarctica is isolated and falls into what we call the deep freeze, where the climate is really, really cold. And in essence, we have development of gradually more and more stable ice sheets over the Antarctic continent. So what are the key geological processes that shaped the Antarctic continent? Well, one you can directly see from that animation. We have a process that separates the other continents from the Antarctic core. So one key process that we need to understand if we are to understand the geology and its controls on the overlying ice sheets is the process of rifting, which is very schematically shown here. So rifting is in essence a process of extensional tectonics that eventually can lead to the separation of continents. And it's often accompanied by magnetism, and sometimes it proceeds to full development of an ocean. So we studied this key process of continental rifting in a variety of different regions. One of them is Western Running Water. And here, major rift structures, as I will show you, are directly concealed by ice streams, fast-flowing glaciers of the East Antarctic ice sheet. This region has become very interesting also because, as well as being an area where people have suggested that the supercontinent Gondwana started to break off, it has also been proposed that this was a site of a much older process of collision that may have happened something like a billion years ago. And so this area provides us with a glimpse into a very long-term evolution of the Antarctic continent. This is a sketch that shows you this progression from about a billion years ago to 500 million years ago, and finally to a stage of rifting that some have suggested may even be related or in some way be an initial stage of rifting similar to what we observe in East Africa. This is a rather complicated geological maps. I won't go too much in detail, but what I want to show you is how we can actually trace these rifts under the ice with the airborne geophysics. So this is an image of the radar, and you can see these deep blue colors. These are deep subglacial basins that go up to 1.5 to 2 kilometers below sea level. So they're beautifully delineated in the radar. And then you see these red colors. These are the mountains under the ice that flank the rift. So even just the radar on its own provides us with a unique glimpse into these rifts under the ice. But, of course, it can't provide us with indications on the subglacial geology on its own. And this is where the magnetics really comes into play. So here you see again blue and red colors. Blue colors are rocks that are weakly magnetic. And you can beautifully see this blue line there under the Jutostrand ice stream. And this is the best signature of the rift under the ice. And you can see these red colors on the sides of the rift. These are the mountains at the side, the flanks of the rift. And these rocks on the two sides of the rift are very different one from the other. The ones on the left-hand side are about 1.1 billion-year-old flood basalts that were probably in place during breakup of a very old supercontinent. And rocks on the right are completely different. These are magmatic arc rocks related to subduction about a billion years ago. So basically, you can see that the magnetics, in essence, gives us an imprint of this rifting process and of the geology. Again, we don't need to worry about the detail, but this is just a diagram to show you how we can develop tectonic sketch matches for subglacial regions using aeromagnetics. So the blue colors here are interpreted as the extent of the rift, and then we have the contrasting geology on the two different flanks of the rift. We can go further than that if we're lucky enough to have detailed structural interpretations from structural geology or other methods. We can start correlating the magnetic signatures with the geology and develop more detailed interpretations. This is an example of gravity over a rift zone. And here again, simple things. Red colors are areas where the crust is denser or thinner, and blue colors are areas where the crust is less dense or thicker. And so here you can clearly see these broad regions of red colors that indicate the extent of the rifted crust, in contrast to the blue colors that show you the rift plain. And we can develop models of this, quite detailed models in 3D, which allows to give a glimpse onto the deep structure of the rift. In this case, for example, one of the key findings was that we found that the Jutostrand rift was underlain by about 30 kilometers thick crust, which is about 10 kilometers thinner than the crust that we have on the flank of the rift itself. So this is just an example to show us something about continental rifting in Antarctica. And you can see how the airborne geophysics has allowed us to image some of the earliest stages of Gondwana breakup in this region, but also look at how different these rifts can be compared to adjacent rifts in Africa, and to study how ancient, very old, maybe even 1 billion-year-old structures control the location of much more recent rifting about 180 million years ago. Although rifting in this region is very interesting as a basic geologic process, the implications in terms of its controls on an area of the ice sheet are somewhat less significant. As we go into Western Antarctica, the study of the geology, it becomes absolutely critical because it provides a boundary condition to look at the long-term stability of the ice sheet. And we focus on a very particular region of the ice sheet that is changing very rapidly today. And this is the Amundsen Sea embayment region, where two major glaciers, known as Pine Island Glacier and Thwaites Glacier, are changing very rapidly and already contributing to accelerated global sea level rise. So we wanted to explore with airborne geophysics the topography and the geology that lies beneath these glaciers to help constrain models of their past, present, and future evolution. In particular, this region is thought to be underlain by one of the largest continental rift systems in the whole of the planet. But its extent under the glaciers has, until recently, really been very poorly understood, let alone its controls on ice dynamics. So, we did an extensive airborne geophysical survey over this region, and you can see that there are these big question marks in that area, and those are put there to denote that, in essence, although we have good knowledge of this huge rift system, the western part of the rift system in the Ross Sea region, really and truly very little was known upon the extent under the Amundsen Sea embayment itself. So, the question there, but where does the rift go? Exploring this region in West Antarctica was really quite a formidable challenge. So in addition to the aircraft that you've already seen that we used to do the survey, we had to use much larger aircraft to deploy the fuel. This is an LC-130. And also, it became obvious that we couldn't do it on our own. We had to do it with international partners, and in essence, these partners were the Americans that provided the second Twin Otter aircraft. And using two different Twin Otter aircraft, we were really able to maximize the area that we could explore. So this shows you the flight lines that we flew over the area. Those dark purple colors that you see show you the extreme velocities of the Pine Island glacier. The glacier there is moving at speeds up and even over 2 kilometers per year. So it's a very fast flowing glacier. And you can see that our flight lines provide a first reconnaissance coverage over this area. And we also started to do some more detailed work over the trunk of the glacier itself. So one of the key revelations that came out of the survey was the topography itself under the glacier. So you can now see very clearly the deep linear basin under the Pine Island Glacier and these much broader basins called Byrd's Glacial Basin and the Bentley Subglacial Trench further to the south. In general, you can see that all of this region has very low elevation in contrast to what we think are the rift flanks over the Ellsworth Mountains and the Hudson Mountains. This is an example of the gravity data that we got over the same area, and the map on the left-hand side is what is known as free air gravity map, which in essence mimics is very similar to the subglacial topography map. So it's strongly influenced by the topography that lies beneath the ice. So once again, you can really beautifully see the basin that lies under Pine Island and these broader features, the Byrd Subglacial Basin and the Bentley Subglacial Trench. When we take out the effect of the topography, we get what's called the Boog anomaly. And here you can see, once again, these red colors in contrast to the blue colors. And in a very simple way, in essence, this delineates the region with the much thinner crust of the Western Antarctic Rift System compared to the flanks, the Western Antarctic Rift flank. So immediately, basically, the gravity here provides us with a nice image of the extent of the previously very poorly understood extent of the rift under this changing part of the ice sheet. This is a little bit more complicated, but in essence, all it's showing you is that we can use this data to infer how thick the crust is. And an amazing discovery here was that the crust under Pine Island Glacier is the thinnest crust that we have observed so far under the entire West Antarctic Ocean. The crust is only about 20 kilometers thing. And this may have very significant implications on geothermal heat flux under this region. Another incredible discovery that came out of the survey in this region was the realization that potentially quite close to the glacier, there may have been very recent volcanoes. So there are exposures of quite recent volcanics in the Hudson Mountains that flank Fine Island, but we found in the radar a very bright layer that we interpreted as a possible tephra layer related to a recent volcanic eruption. And this is undoubtedly something quite interesting. Volcanism, in addition to rifting, may be a way of providing an enhanced geothermal heat flux to this region and increase the availability of water under this part of the ice sheet. What we're currently doing is we're looking more into the magnetics to try and understand how the rocks that are exposed here in the Hudson Mountains, the volcanic rocks, may extend under the ice sheet, and if we can use this data indeed to learn more about the distribution of the volcanics in relation to the rifting and potentially even heat flow. I will skip on this, it's a little bit complicated. I will directly go to what I think is a really exciting project that we did in the interior of East Antarctica, which is called AGA. And what we did here is we explored the enigmatic Gambertsev Mountains in the interior of Antarctica. So I will show you something about the enigma of these mountains in the middle of East Antarctica, some hypotheses that have been formulated for the origin of these mountains, and then I will be showing you some new airborne geophysical images that were collected over this region that 50 years after the enigma of these mountains actually came up, I think help provide a solution for the origin of the mountains. So these mountains in the middle of East Antarctica were discovered really by chance, as many of the discoveries in Antarctica actually are. So the Russians were had a tractor train and were traversing across Antarctica. And surprisingly, while they were going across East Antarctica, they found a very high mountain range in the interior of what is assumed to be a very stable and ancient pre-Cambrian crater. And generally speaking, the landscape in these old craterlands is very low-lying, rather featureless and not that exciting. Whilst here, in the middle of East Antarctica, they found a mountain range that looked like the Alps. Since then, it's actually been very difficult to actually reach this mountain range and understand more about its origin. So as I said before, the origin has really remained somewhat of a mystery for over 50 years. So you might say, well, who cares really about the origin of these mountains? Well, these mountains were actually absolutely critical because it was on top of these mountains that we think that the Antarctic ice sheet started to form. But there's more to it. Ice sheet and climate models show that even if we increased the temperature about 20 degrees more than present day, the ice sheet would probably still resist over the Gambertsev subglacial mountain. So in essence, these mountains are actually quite key to the long-term stability of the ice sheet itself. I'm saying that for about 50 years, it was really quite difficult to get some data over this region. But there was then a traverse that was done by the Chinese in this area, as they are basically planning to build a base in this area because it's the highest spot on the ice sheet beneath Domain. And this first traverse around the region of Domain provided us with a beautiful glimpse into what lay beneath. And one of the key discoveries there was that deep valleys were found that strongly resemble fluvial systems that had been over-deepened by early glaciation. So this was the first sort of glimpse into the fact that the Gambertsers really existed prior to the formation of the ice sheet, and that they bear some sort of imprint of the evolution of the ice sheet, the long-term evolution of the ice sheet since about 34 million years ago. Although this provides us with a really nice picture of its of the potential landscape evolution in the area, little was learned about the geological processes that actually created the mountains in the first place. So what are the ideas on how these mountains might have formed in the middle of Eastern Tartary? Well, people have tried to explain this in a variety of reasons, or in a variety of models. So one idea is that perhaps these mountains were related to some far-field compressional event. Perhaps, for example, related to Pangaea. But although these models are somewhat attractive, there was very little real geological evidence or geophysical evidence in support of this. And the scenario here might be a bit similar to the Mongolian plateau or Altai that are quite far away from the collisional suture zone between India and Asia, but still represent very high ground and high elevation mountains. However, a big problem with this scenario is that these far-field processes are thought to have occurred some 300 million years ago. And so how do you preserve this mountain range for over 300 million years, even if this process did indeed occur? So there are other ideas out there on the possible origin of this mountain range. One idea was that perhaps the mountains were actually sitting atop of a mantle plume, and that perhaps the Gambertsers could resemble for example, the Hoggar Swell in Africa, that is in essence directly related to a mantle plume. And all data that we had on the topography of the Gambertsers indeed suggested that perhaps the geometry of the mountain range might be somewhat similar to the Hoggar Swell. Other ideas were that perhaps this region was a broad plateau that was preserved from erosion because of a cap of rocks that were more difficult to erode, like flood basalts. And an analogy for this might be the Lesotho Islands, again, in Africa. However, more recently, people have tried to use proxies from sediment cores offshore the Lambert Glacier. And they have concluded that there was very little evidence for volcanic rock that might indeed be expected in a plume scenario. In fact, all of the material they recovered was extraordinarily old, at least 500 million years, really making the enigma even greater as to how these mountains may. People have tried to place large collisional sutures in the middle of East Antarctica, perhaps related to supercontinental assembly. Again, these sutures are very old, maybe up to 700 million years ago. And so these, again, present some sort of problems in actually relating them directly to a mountain range that looks so young. And geophysics have also been used to try and suggest that perhaps there were some sutures here. This is from a satellite gravity image. And there have been suggestions that perhaps thickened crust there might be related to these old orogenic processes. However, the best evidence for what might have happened in this region comes from geological observations in the adjacent Lambert Glacier region. Here, we actually can see, using the geology, that there definitely was quite a significant process of continental rifting. And this is a key part, in my view, of the puzzle for the Gambertsers.
influences of glacial mantles.
We know that there were at least two stages of extension in the Lambert Glacier, one that occurred about 280 million years ago, and another that occurred about 100 million years ago. And these are basically a sort of precursor to the breakup of Gondwana, and in the second stage actually accompanied the break-off of India from Antarctica. The idea that rifting might be important to explain the origin of the Gamberts came from also from some geophysical data that was acquired by the Australians at the margin of the Gamberts. This is from a paper that was published in 2009. And you can really see, now that you've seen other better-known examples, you can really quite clearly see these linear rift basins that get at least to the northern margin of the Gamberts subglacial mantles. But, as I said before, because of the paucity of data over the interior of East Antarctica, it was really quite difficult, if not impossible, to understand if the range itself was directly related to the rift. This is a magnetic map for the region, still from a previous paper that was published in 2009, and this provided us with quite a nice view on the basement terrains under the region, but did not really solve the puzzle of the Gamberts themselves. So what we did is we performed an extensive survey of the region. We collected about 120,000 line kilometers of data. This shows the different nations that were involved there. In order to explore this region, seven nations had to pool their resources. This is a real frontier region that's really hard to explore. You can see there are two colors there. The dark orange are the lines that the British Antarctic Survey flew, and these are the pale lines which the Americans flew. And I'm quite proud to say that the Americans had a team of about 50 people on the ground, flew about 60,000 line kilometers, and we had a team of about 8 people on the ground, and we flew about 60,000 line kilometers. So, this is a brand new view of what the Gamberts look like under the ice sheet, and this is how I have interpreted the Gamberts subglacial mantles. What I have suggested from the new airborne geophysical data is that the Gamberts are directly related to a process of continental rifting, and indeed that in East Antarctica we have one of the largest continental rift systems in the world of the same size and general architecture as the well-known East Antarctic rift system. This is an image that shows you what the lithosphere under the Gamberts looks like. So what you can clearly see is that under the Gamberts we have these nice dark purple colors. And what those are showing us is basically that the lithosphere under the Gamberts is typical fast Precambrian lithosphere. It is certainly nothing like this red color that you see here. This is an area that we know is underlain by a mantle pool. So you can clearly see that today the Gamberts subglacial mantles are not underlain by a mantle pool. So this clearly shows you that at least one of the models that have been previously proposed for the Gamberts is virtually untenable. But also you can see that when we use the geological data to look at previous collisional origins over this region, you can see that these features here correspond to regions where the lithosphere has clearly been reworked and is very different from the lithosphere that lies under the Gamberts themselves. So in order to try and understand the broader picture of the gambit, since we had to patch together all of the existing surveys, the red lines showing you the new AGAP data, and this really provides us with the most comprehensive view so far of interior eastern Thailand, and allowed us to a certain extent to delineate these rifts flanking the gambit. This is an example of satellite magnetic data which we use to try and understand the broader context within Antarctica of the Gambertsis. And you can immediately see something very important from this satellite map. You can see that the region of the Gambertsis is very different from what lies on the sides. So here you have blue colours and here you have red colours. And the great thing about this is that we can directly see that there is clearly a different province under the Gambertsis. And we believe that this was a very distinct Precambrian suture zone that basically was related to the collision of different blocks in the interior of Eastern Thailand. This is a more complicated map that shows you the same thing. Here, you can see something else which is really important in understanding the Gambertsis. You can see that the Gambertsis are underlain by deep blue colours in the Bouguenomer. And as you've seen before from known examples, where we have these deep blue colours, this indicates that the crust is thicker. And so you can clearly see that the Gambertsis are underlain by much thicker crust compared to other regions of Eastern Thailand. You can also see these red colours that you now know are clearly related to rifting processes. So this shows you a detail of the topography, and you can really beautifully see these distinct basins that wrap around the Gambertsis and that we interpret as rift basins. Some of these basins also contain some of the largest subglacial lakes in the whole of Eastern Thailand, like Lake Vostok, Lake Soletskaya, and Lake Nangis. So the discovery of these rift basins will provide also a template for other more detailed studies of the lakes themselves. This is the magnetic anomaly map for the same region, and here you can see really beautifully in the magnetics a very large contrast between the patterns that we see here and the patterns that we see here, and we believe that this is an imprint of a major suture zone that was related to collision of two different blocks. And this collisional process occurred somewhere in the Precambrian, we believe probably about 1.1 billion years ago. This is the gravity map for the region. This map is now superimposed upon recent seismological data for the region. And so here, what you need to note is that the dark blue colours, which you know now from the gravity showing thick crust, correspond very well with these purple colours, where the independent seismic data suggests very thick crust. So you can see that from the seismic estimates, the crust under this part of the Gambertsis is over 50 kilometers thick. This is the result of a combined modeling effort that uses gravity and seismology to infer the crustal thickness in the region. And once again, you can see blue colors here clearly showing you a very thick region of crust surrounded by red colors that show you the extent of the rift wrapping around the Gambertsis. So this is really quite a clear image, in my view, of a block that is surrounded by a major rift system. We can look into this into more detail, and we can do models of this, and in essence, look at the detailed architecture of the rift to try and understand the processes that are involved. What normally occurs in mountain ranges is that when we create a the mountains. The mountains themselves are supported by a root. When these mountains are then completely demolished by erosion, generally this root also disappears and is not preserved. Everything turns to go back to equilibrium. And in essence, the crust is generally about 35 to 40 kilometers thick. However, there are some places in the world, for example, the Urals and the Trans-Hudson origin, that are examples of old origins where this thick root was actually preserved. We believe that this is exactly what happened also in the Gamboa's Glacial Mountains. So the root was actually preserved under these mountains. This was really quite an important finding. So there's quite a thick and dense root under them. And as we saw before, the Gamboa's are clearly surrounded by rifts themselves. So what we can then do is we can develop new models of the uplift of the Gamboa's by using the topography and the gravity data. And here you can see different curves that were calculated for the region. And basically, the most important one you need to look at is this purple line here, which is the sum of all these different effects. So the erosion, the rifting, and the pre-existing root. And in essence, this diagram shows you that the combination of these processes can explain the Gamboa's. So in essence, the enigma can be solved by assuming that there's a root under the Gamboa's, that there was rifting that broke the plate and flexed up the crust, and that there was significant isostatic response to the incision of these valleys. And this is really what is responsible for this modern-looking landscape of the Gamboa's. So, this is a summary. How were the Gamboa's mountains formed? Well, the thick root formed during the Precambrian. Contrary to most origins in the world, the root was preserved for a very long time. Permian and Cretaceous age rifting, about 280 and 100 million years ago, created what we know as a phenomenon of rift-like uplift that probably also rejuvenated this root, contributing to the uplift of the mountains. And the final stage that is really responsible for the landscape as we see it today is really related to the valley incision and peak uplift as an isostatic response to the process. So, I think this is quite a beautiful example of exploration. The new Abu geophysical imaging has revealed two absolutely critical pieces of the puzzle to understand the origin and evolution of the Gamboa's. One, the crustal architecture of this huge rift system, which is the size of the East African rift system in the interior of East Antarctica, and that is a mosaic of different provinces, of Precambrian provinces, probably related to a process of collision that influenced the uplift of the mountains themselves. And so, in essence, we have a new model for this range that combines tectonic and isostatic processes to unravel the enigma. So this is a team that was used out there, a multinational team with the background of our aircraft. And finally, this is a photo of my new Emma that I hope will be a next generation Antarctic scientist. In fact, she's holding her hand like that and saying, "Oh my God." So thank you very much for your attention.
Questions first.
You've got a mountain belt, you've got a root of a mountain belt. Why don't you just think that the mountain belt is still thickened lithosphere? Why do you want to remove the mountain belt and then rejuvenate it with extension?
It's a good question. The key finding comes from the potential fields. So basically the potential fields show you that all the trends are oblique to the present-day topography. So all of the root formation process, we believe, happened much earlier as part of a collision. Because we can see that these magnetic trends are sub-parallel and quite similar to the trends that we see over exposed Granvillian age, about 1.1 billion year old rocks, we think that the process probably occurred at that time. It was a period of, we know, of supercontinental assembly, and we think that's the most likely period. The alternative could be during the Pan-African age assembly, but when one looks globally, most of the roots related to these Pan-African origins have actually detached and are not there anymore. And so we sort of prefer the concept of it being a much older root. We don't think there's any evidence, any independent geological evidence for a major collisional process that could have occurred recently. And another reason why
But isn't that, so yes, exactly, so you've got an old route, you've got an old mountain chain. Why do you want to suddenly rejuvenate it with the extension? Why do you want to create that topography through extension? Why not? Why isn't it just there? You've got a route, it's an old route, you're always going to have topography with a route. You're not going to, it doesn't make mechanical, Archimedes wouldn't believe in this big route without any topography to it, it's going to bounce up.
Understood the question. So what we think happened was that the root was preserved because of its high density. So it was very, very high density. So it was high density, had very little buoyancy. Yes. So that's the sort of concept, is it was preserved because it was a very high density root. And it's this very high density, in essence, that we actually need to reconcile the seismology with the ground. So in essence, the seismology finds really very thick crust. We found a route that was not as thick from the gravity. And the easiest way to reconcile those two results is actually that the route is very dense. And so we think that it's a process of densification of the route. The route was therefore preserved for a very long period of time. It wouldn't really have done that much, let's say, over 500 to 600 million years, until rifting happened. At that stage, there was basically a major plate break there, and there was a normal process of flexure, but the width of the origin is related to the rejuvenation of the root. So it's quite a complex scenario. I guess tests of this could be provided by wide-angle seismic data to, first of all, verify whether our, let's say, interpretation of this thick root is indeed viable or not. The second, of course, critical test, would be drilling. So managing to drill there and to start looking at the rocks, of course, would be a critical test. So in our view, what you would find if you drill there would be about Granvillian age rocks. And we think what you would probably find is evidence for uplift about 100 million years ago, and then you'd have a third stage which would be related to basically a valid decision, so it would be a more recent phase. That's our model.
What kind of mist what do you think they're made of?
We think they are made fundamentally of Precambrian rock. So they are made of rock that's relatively similar to the rocks that are exposed, let's say, within the Granvillian age mobile belts in the Lambert Glacier region, so also in Iceland, primarily. Those give these quite distinctive magnetic anomalies over the exposed rocks of the Lambert Glacier, and we think the magnetic anomalies are relatively similar.
I don't know. That's what I thought they were sort of using the fact quite a complex geological tectonic history.
Yeah.
What you're saying with this mountain that they have, it's had a very simple.
No, it's had a sum of different events. Like, let's say if you went into if you went to Colorado, right, you would see old Precambrian rocks, right? So you can see something relatively similar, really. And then you can see ancestral Colorado plateau, and a very similar thing would happen here, basically. So you probably had an origin about a billion years ago, which was related to some collision in the interior of East Antarctica. Then you might have had some intraplate activity about 500 million years ago, but we don't think you had major collision then. And then you have drifting at the sides of this block, which is a mechanically rigid block and was not affected, basically, by the drifting process directly. And so then you would presumably see some imprint of this in the rocks themselves. And finally, it's really the process of incision of these valleys that is absolutely critical for uplifting the peaks themselves. It's quite similar to what has been proposed also for the Transantarctic Mountains, where there have been suggestions that perhaps 50% of the elevation may be directly related to this incision process. So, no, I think it is quite complicated, but the single phases of this have been observed in other mountain ranges.
Well, to drill it means that if it does, it's better that the ice stay on the thick. So how close to the surface do you
get? So, the thinnest ice that we observed is about 310 meters thick, but we also sounded what I think is probably the thickest ice that's been found so far, is about 4,900 meters. So it's a lot of variation. The really thick ice is in these tributaries of the Lambert Glacier. It's really strong. So there's a.
I think that's the weekend.
It's very close to the exposures in the Baltimore Scarpment. So it's really the tip of the Gambiasis. And the real problem there is that although the ice is thin, I think that sits very close to the exposed Archean rock. And so my impression is that if you drill there, you will probably get something quite similar to what is exposed over the rugged terrain. I don't think you would really be able to validate or refute the model that you
could do thermochronology on it.
We could do thermochronology, yes, that would already be. And of course, the great advantage would be that this would be a little bit more in the interior. So that would already be a start. So my perplexity with all these proxies that we get offshore is that they don't seem to see, for example, the Archean rocks. Actually exposed. That makes me wonder whether they are indeed sounding the interior, because we definitely do have an Archean terrain there, which is also very well distinguished in the magnetics. The numbers are completely different. So, yes, we need to go further in the interior.
Sorry. No, so, do you know what the Chinese plans are for drilling?
No. They have been, as far as I know, they've been saying that they want to drill there for many years. But I suspect that something will happen at Dome. But, yes, anything would be better than nothing, definitely, having some sort of insight there. In the ideal scenario, what one would do would be to drill in the proposed rift basins and in two or three locations at least over the Gambiasis.
Forgive my naivety, my question, because I'm not a chocolate fork, but you mentioned that these mountains might be the ice kind of, does the ice and the thickness of the ice and the weight of the ice, does that play any part, influence any of these underlying geological processes, or is it just essentially just something you've got to get past to actually get to it?
Well, no, it does influence, because the weight of the ice sheet actually makes the mountains lower. So if you took that ice sheet off, those mountains would be 700 meters higher. So basically, that's the extraordinary thing. These mountains would be really, really high. They're already today, with the ice sheet on top, there's 4 kilometers of relief from the base of the Lambert up to the peaks of the Gamberts. And that relief would not change. It would still be 4 kilometers. But the general elevation would be about 3,300 meters. So they would be really, really high.
And the mountains under ice, do they get eroded? Presumably they still get physically eroded.
That's a very good question.
Do the ice is still moving, but there's not kind of exposure to water and winded air and winded light and that sort of stuff?
That's a very good question. So the idea is that the long-term preservation of the Gamberts may indeed reflect the long-term glaciation. It's a fossilized mountain chain. But the great thing, if the model that I'm suggesting is true, at about 100 million years, right, Antarctica is in a very stable polar position.
Right.
And so it's a fantastic position to be, because basically as you get the rift line uplift, which is already a form of sort of permanent uplift in some senses, instead of getting a lot of erosion rates drop down dramatically. But there still is selective erosion in these valleys. So you maintain the regional elevation high, and at the same time you can uplift the peaks a lot. You don't have a mechanism that's competing to erode all of these peaks. So it's quite a wonderful preservation story there.
Did you get any of the sort of geological structure of the rock where it falls and things like that? Maybe it falls into the ice, or does that all disappear?
No, it all disappears. So we don't have any direct view of these faults. We can only observe them in the Lambert Glacier, so the outcrops in the Lambert Glacier, and there. That's why I think the rifting scenario is so attractive, because that's really what we can see from the geological record. We can see those faults related to the rifting. We don't have to invoke some really different mechanism. We can see that from the rocks. We know that happened. So I think that's the attractive part of the story. But the other parts are a little bit less convincing.
Questions? Anything from the undergraduates, maybe? Well, I'll say final one, right? Have you got any more fieldwork planned for the AS?
Well, we hope so, yes. Yes, well, we would love to actually be able to explore from the new base that is being built in Antarctica. It's called Halley, which is a potential gateway to explore the interior of Eastern Antarctica. So that's certainly an area we would love to go to. But we're also hoping to be able to work with Australians and others to explore Eastern Antarctica, trace around the coast some of these major faults that we think exist in the interior of the continent.
Okay, well, you're all welcome to stay and help us finish off the refreshments, although it sounds like Mikkel's knocked over the beer. So it might be a bit silty, and first of all, we'll be around for a little while longer if you have any more questions or comments.
I have a video that I can show on my laptop.
Yeah, you might show that during the wine as well if you're going to stay. But we say thanks again.
Thank you.